It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Thank you for finding the time. I will admit, it's not entirely unpleasant seeing you again. A lot of time has passed. By the look of it, you've come up in the world.
I could say the same about you.
The mayor serves his city. I can see you're not entirely convinced.
Can you blame me? I can't shake the feeling that you're gaming the system.
Why did you stop being a vigilante?
The line was crossed.
It's hard to come to terms with a violent nature. Hating the power it has over us.
This city can't go unchecked.
Sometimes, peace needs to be broken. And chaos must reign.
Mind putting the hatchet down? I was raised to believe in grace. But I was also raised believe in retribution.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Yours? And I was tempted to say Back to the Bins, but if you were listening to Back to the Bins that posted the day before this, you heard myself with Mr. Sean Whalen and Mr. Chris Eberle waxing poetic about the Frank Miller Daredevil comic book run. And today on Is It Yours, I have the same two guests. Hi, guys.
Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here, buddy.
Thanks for having us on.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. And our plan is to go a little bit off format. We're not discussing one film. We're not discussing a TV movie. We're not discussing a TV series. We're discussing all three of the above. We are here to take a look at Daredevil on film as a compliment to our Frank Miller Daredevil Back to the Bins episode, because even the Trial of the Incredible Hulk is influenced by Frank Miller's Daredevil to an extent. So they are all somehow the children of Frank Miller. You know, as we were just talking about before we started to record, I'm a little older than you guys. So I think when the Trial of the Incredible Hulk came out, I probably had a very different perspective on it than you. By the time we got to the Daredevil movie and the Daredevil TV series, I'm thinking you had caught up to me as far as your anticipation levels and that type of thing. So let's talk about the Trial of the Incredible Hulk first. I remember watching this. It was 1987 that was on. And so that would mean I was, 1989. Mm-hmm. That would mean I was actually in law school at the time that this occurred. And I was not actively collecting comics, but I still had a fondness for them at that time. And I was able to kind of watch this with muted expectations and enjoy it to a degree, although I can't say I liked the way Daredevil was portrayed. Now, you guys, again, being younger, might have had a little bit more leniency as far as your expectations. Why don't you tell me what you guys thought, since you're both shaking your head so much I can almost hear rattling.
Sean, go ahead.
So 89 was my senior year in high school. It's also the year that Batman was released in the theaters with Keaton. This is also following Thor and Hulk teaming up.
I wasn't sure which came first, this one or the Thor one. I couldn't remember.
Thor was first. And I was a big fan of the Bill Bixby show. Growing up as a kid, I really, really enjoyed Bill Bixby. I enjoyed Lou Ferrigno. The weekly Hulk TV series just worked for me at the time. This coming back was kind of like, I was looking for it to be a nostalgia fest. The Thor one, I hated. I'll clarify a little bit. I really liked Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno, but their portrayal of Thor I didn't like. We'll set that one aside. So I walked into this one with very low expectations because of the feeling for that one. I remember liking this one a little better, but it still left me with that same feeling. I'm trying to remember back what I was thinking in 89. I don't remember being really super impressed with either movie. Flash forward to now, I watched it for this just to see, because I didn't remember enough of it, truthfully, to kind of have any comments about it. And in the rewatch, I was pleasantly surprised at how I enjoyed it. I'm not ranking it up there with some of the other things we're going to be talking about today, but I certainly was not as bad as I remembered it being. That did not motivate me to go watch the Thor one. I want to be very clear off of that, but I did watch it for this piece. We'll talk more about this as we carry on the conversation, but in 89, I remember just not liking this, because of, the portrayal of Daredevil. It just wasn't really my thing at the time. Chris?
So in 89, I was a sophomore in high school and I already read all the Miller work. I'd read Born Again many, many times already. So for my age, I was well-versed, and like Sean, I grew up watching The Incredible Hulk. I love the show. I love Bill Bixby. I always enjoyed it as a kid. And I'd watch the specials they did. The Thor film, I mean, I haven't watched these since they were on television the first time, which will probably tell you a lot about what I thought of them. But the Thor one, like, it was like in a cheap Halloween costume. It was just utterly atrocious. But I'm so loved Daredevil already by that point. I was certainly willing to give this a shot. And we have to remember, it was such a dearth of, you know, other media when it came to these characters. I mean, as we enter the 90s, you start to see more stuff emerging, a little bit of a good, a lot of a terrible. Batman, of course, was in the former. But when watching this, and admittedly, I'm just kind of remembering the basics of it, I just thought he looked, Daredevil just, I didn't care the way he designed him. I mean, it was like the typical, we can't do the real cost. We don't think it's going to look right. So we're going to put him in a body stocking. It just didn't work. Nothing against, you know, well, I honestly don't remember who the actor was who portrayed him, but.
Rex Smith.
Well, thank you. That's why you're you, sir. Producer extraordinaire. But I just remember being very disappointed. And wasn't the Kingpin in it?
Yes. John Rhys-Davies, who played Sala in Raiders of the Lost Ark, was Kingpin.
Wonderful actor, but I remember he had like these ridiculous sunglasses on, if I remember correctly. And I remember thinking as a kid, like, because you'd read all the Miller stuff with the Kingpin and Spider-Man 4. I was like, this is not the Kingpin. Like, there was no physical intimidation. It was just like kind of like rubbing his hands together, like, and I put the girl on the train tracks type. It was awful. my general recollection.
I remember seeing this back in 1989, I think I probably set the timer on my VCR and came home late one night and watched it and was fully unimpressed at the time. But I wasn't bothered by it. And I thought that might be the difference between being a little older, because when I was younger, I was more tolerant of anything I could get with superheroes. I was happy to have. And then the older I got, I became a little bit more, you know, that, you know, I wanted to see something special in order to be impressed. What I saw here in my rewatch of it was kind of the framework of the Miller Daredevil, but then just nothing in the execution. You know, you had the Kingpin as the Kingpin of crime controlling Manhattan and really just, you know, having his fingers in everything and manipulating things behind the scenes, having, you know, corrupt officials and you know, just kind of ruling the gangs and all of that. So that you had that. Daredevil was not really the Miller Daredevil, you know, and I'll talk a little bit, well, we could talk a little bit about that in a minute. But I thought the whole effort to have Kingpin as the villain and to have him be truly the Kingpin of crime in that area, I thought that was an effort to be going after the Miller vibe, and I just don't think they hit it. And I think part of the reason was, as most of the time that when we attack these such movies, I think most of the times it was the script. I think they needed to give Kingpin a little bit more, make him more threatening, make him a little bit more intimidating. And this isn't something that's coming from the most recent viewing, you know, seeing that and comparing it. This is what I thought at the time, and I continue to think that. That he just wasn't the scary Kingpin villain that I thought he needed to be. And that would have made a big difference to me.
I think we have to remember that there's also the limitations of the time in terms of how comics were viewed. Granted, they were in the 80s, you know, you have the gritty, grim and gritty movement, and, you know, but that's not necessarily crossing over into, you know, wider multimedia. And, you know, for a lot of people, you know, it's bam, pow, biff, ziff, zam, whatever. And, you know, there's still that sort of general sense. And I mean, the Bill Bixby Hulk show was delightful. But I mean, it's also very goofy. It's very much a product of its time. And, you know, there are also the limitations of the special effects that were available to them then. But to go back to your point, I just don't think the mentality was there yet for the kind of scripts that we were getting in the comics. That I just don't think that was happening really yet in these adaptations. And even going to the 90s, like who can forget the horrific Gen X television movie or the Nick Fury, David Hasselhoff? I mean, they're all awful. And a lot of, like you said, comes back to these scripts that just don't, I'm just talking out of my butt. I have no idea. I'm just conjecturing, but were they afraid to kind of make that leap into what the comics were really doing? They just feel that wasn't the right medium for it. I don't know, but it just, there's this whole period where all this stuff just has this, you're excited to see it because you're, like you said, you really want to see these characters you love in a different medium. And for the most part, they just couldn't do it.
The one thing that I liked about this in my recent viewing of it that I don't think I was ready to catch because I was so down on the Daredevil appearance. There are some great sequences actually between David Banner and Matt Murdock. There's a sequence where Murdock gets beat up pretty badly and starts to question himself and question his abilities as Daredevil. And he and David Banner, who have become friends at this point, ish, you know, the way that you do in these kind of team up things. Banner and him had some really good banter between them where Banner was kind of, you got to see where two heroes who are dealing with their own inner demons were kind of feeding off of each other and trying to help each other into a better place and acceptance of who they are and what positives they can bring to the table. It was an interesting sort of interplay between the two. And I didn't remember any of that watching it back in 89. So I was fascinated that I'm like, oh, I'm finding some nuggets of this that I actually really like. It was clearly an extra long episode of The Incredible Hulk, that being the foundational piece of it. And it worked in that that sense, but it did not work in the sense of being a episode of or a Daredevil vehicle. We just lost Paul, so.
Well, Sean, the fact that you found those nuggets makes you want to go and watch it, because to be fair, I haven't watched it since 1989. So, and it left such a negative impression on me, but you know, that's the kind of thing that maybe I wouldn't have appreciated as much perhaps back then than I might today. So where can you find this, by the way?
So I have it on iTunes.
Okay.
I have the whole Hulk series on iTunes, and truthfully, because I it was one of those deals where like sometimes you're going through Apple's things and they've got a sale, mm-hmm. and they had the series The Incredible Hulk on iTunes. So the TV movies are separate, and I ended up grabbing both of them. I feel icky saying I bought the Thor one. I have not watched the Thor one. And this is the comic book completionist in me that grabbed them for that reason. So I will totally admit it was, I've got to catch them all. And I ended up grabbing the other two. The Daredevil one though, I admit I wanted to see that one again, just to see what it was like. And then when we were planning to do this, I'm like, well, I should rewatch it just to see what it was like. It surprised me. I'm not saying that it was, I mean, certainly we're going to be talking about the Netflix series and the Disney Plus series. It's not going to, you know, sit there and be a competitor for that. But there were pieces in there that I really enjoyed more than I thought I was going to this time around. I think
I did enjoy the interaction between Bruce Banner and Matt Murdock. Mm-hmm. I did think there was something there that I thought, you know, Bill Bixby, I wouldn't go as far as to say Bill Bixby's a great actor, but I think Bill Bixby is a solid actor. And I think he knew what it took to give his performances, which was borne out by the fact that later on he became a director. And, you know, I think he knew what to put on the screen. So I think he kind of carried it a little bit. I think Rex Smith was more of you know, I think he was a singer, if I recall right. I think he was a teenage pop star at one time. And I think, you know, he dabbled in acting, and I think he gave it a real try here, but I don't think he's a great actor by any stretch of the imagination. And I think it's shown a little bit every once in a while where he's doing the blind thing where you just kind of look into space, mm-hmm. and you're not focusing on anything. And then every once in a while you see his eyes start focusing on something. So, you know, it's not a great performance by any stretch, but I do think there was a little bit of a chemistry between the two in how they did their roles. So I think that was probably the highlight of the movie, frankly. But, you know, I mean, it was, you know, Sean and I have talked in the past about how sometimes you have to take these movies for what they are at the time and not really compare them to what's going on today. To compare them to like the MCU movies or the Netflix series or anything like that probably would be unfair, because I don't think those things could be made back in 1989.
No, I agree 100%. I think that's what I was trying to get at before, but perhaps clumsily, is that there's limitations at the time, obviously the technology, but also just, I guess, the sensibility, like what people were willing maybe to how they're willing to give comics a chance, so to speak, in other forms. I mean, what do you guys think about that? That's why I think Batman was so such a breakthrough. Yes. What's that?
You see it develop over the years, and not Batman notwithstanding, even in later movies, like say the X-Men movies when they first started making them, you know, we had to put them in the leather costumes instead of trying to go with the traditional costumes. And I think that came from a sense of, well, people aren't going to take us seriously if we go true to the source material. And then, you know, but eventually they got to X-Men First Class, which I thought was a very, very good movie. Mm-hmm. And that one stayed more true to the source material as far as that goes. I mean, you had Banshee in his costume. You had them all with, you know, with the yellow X-Men costumes and all. I think, you know, eventually as they have matured in their filmmaking, I think there's been an understanding of what can be put on film and what can't be. You know, they didn't go, you know, Sean and I recently discussed the Captain America 1990 movie.
Ah, yes.
And, you know, they had kind of the very, very traditional costume there. That didn't work as well as what they did in the MCU costumes for Captain America, which were more grounded. So I do think you have to find that middle ground every once in a while. You don't want to totally throw it to comic bookness, but you also want to stay true to the source material. And I think by not having Daredevil in anything that even remotely looked like the comic book costume, that took away from this as a comic fan.
Where it succeeded in another area was there was a discovery by the villains of sound and the ability to overwhelm Daredevil's senses. And it played in this. Actually led Bill Bixby to get angry in the sequence, but it was great to see it because it gave a real sense of vulnerability to Daredevil in this that felt comic book accurate in what they were doing. So there were little pieces of nuggets that they were trying to do here that I was like, oh, I was really harsh on some of this. There's pieces in this that I like. So, I mean, it's not the whole thing as a whole doesn't always work, but there were sequences where I'm like, they were trying some good things here. And I think in a lot of the movies that we're talking about here that hadn't quite gotten there yet, I think that's part of the problem. They have these sequences where it's like, oh, you were getting it right. Why didn't you keep going? No. And I feel like that's what a lot of this one had in it. There were some really good bits where there were opportunities that if they had just thematically crafted the whole thing in a similar fashion, I think this would have worked. You're right. Those glasses that the Kingpin was wearing, boy, they were very 80s. They shouldn't have been worn in the 80s, much less being worn by a villain.
So, I mean, we have a lot to cover here, so I'm going to try and move the conversation along a little bit. Anything else about this film that you feel is worth pointing out? Excuse me.
Don't
think so. Chris, if you're not familiar with the Is It Yours rating system, I don't know that you are, we rate them on a scale of Jaws 1 to Jaws 4, which is not necessarily in line with the actual Jaws movies. Jaws 1 is, because if you rate something Jaws 1, you're saying it's an all-time classic great movie.
Jaws
2 is where we start deviating from the films and just create our own rating system. Jaws 2 is a very solid movie, not quite a classic, but something that you could watch multiple times and really enjoy. Jaws 3 is, you know, it was okay. And Jaws 4 was, it was bad. And then we have Jaws 19.
See, I'm a little torn here. I'm a little torn because Jaws 3 was 3D, correct?
Oh, Jaws 3 was awful. Jaws 3 was actually, because we did those movies at one time, Jaws 3 was rated Jaws 4.
Right, because Jaws 4 at least had Michael Caine in it, you know, cashing in a paycheck, which I thought was fun. Because he was in every film made in that time period.
Jaws 4 was better than Jaws 3 as far as the actual movies go. But as far as our rating system goes, we stick by the Jaws 3 being, you know, a decent movie that's a decent watch and Jaws 4 being a bad movie.
Okay.
And so for this movie, I'm going to throw right out there, you know, I rewatched it. I didn't think it was horrible. I didn't feel like, oh my God, I need that time back. But it wasn't good. So I'm going to say, you know, it was borderline Jaws 3. It could have easily sank to Jaws 4, but I'm going to say Jaws 3.
I was expecting this to be a Jaws 4. So I walked in kind of, like, my memories from 89 were that piece. I was pleasantly surprised. I agree with you. It was a Jaws 3. I would say if you like the Incredible Hulk series, this one is worth seeing. Thematically, it is a decent follow-up to the Incredible Hulk series. It's not like this Daredevil vehicle that you're looking for, but there were sequences, and I would say it's a Jaws 3. It's worth a viewing.
I don't think it's fair for me to rate this. I haven't seen it since 1989. I'm just going on some basic recollections. So I don't think I'm going to rate it because I could watch it tomorrow. But you know what? They're right. It is a Jaws 3. So I'll pass.
But your gut feeling is it's a Jaws 4, or is it?
That's my gut feeling, but that's based on, you know, memories of 1989. Yeah.
Sure.
I will side with you. It's an 89 Jaws 4 for me too. But it is Jaws 3 now.
Gotcha.
Okay. So then, you know, they put Daredevil down for a while, and they picked him up again in 2003 when they made a big budget Daredevil movie starring Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner. I got to tell you, I found this movie very disappointing. It has all the flash that you'd want out of a big budget movie, but none of the heart. I feel that the roles were miscast. I think the special effects are not true to the character. They make him almost weightless, like practically flying around in the movie. I know there's a director's cut that improves it slightly, but that's all it does is improve it slightly as far as I'm concerned. I was more disappointed seeing this movie than I was seeing The Trial of the Incredible Hulk.
I concur hardly. I was, so this, what was it, 2003?
Yes.
When it came out? I want to say three?
Yeah, 2003.
So I was really excited for this. Wow, are they really going to do Daredevil, you know, properly? You know, I like Ben Affleck. I thought he was, I was fine with him. This was crushingly disappointing. Like, I think this is a truly awful film on almost every level. We can get into that, but the script was abominable. The minute they didn't let him save the blind guy, I like Jennifer Garner, but totally miscast as Elektra. Totally miscast, completely and utterly. The film just didn't work. The only thing really good about that, Jon Favreau was great as Foggy. That was about it. Kingpin was terrible, terrible, terrible. And I don't blame any of the actors. They had a good cast. But again, like you guys said before, especially with when you're doing these adaptations, if the script doesn't go to the essence of what makes the characters compelling, you're going to get a flat film, and that's what we very much had here.
I think I know what my problem was with this one. So I watched the director's cut, and I actually agree with the if you haven't seen this and you're interested in seeing it, I do recommend seeing the director's cut.
I've seen that too, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit better. It really is. So, I mean, it's out of the two, I would definitely watch that if you've never seen it before. My problem with this time around when I was watching it, there were things that I liked in it, but they were trying to do too much in this film. They were trying to get too much of the Daredevil lore into a film. And I think if they had grabbed one of the big chunks and said, this is the movie we're doing, it would have been a much better film for it. Speed, lightning round, the Elektra story on top of his origin and the, you know, the relationship of all these other characters and what they were doing with Kingpin and Karen Page. It was way too much for one Daredevil movie. I appreciated that they were putting the lore in. So when I was watching it, I'm like, oh, great, they did that and they did that. But why so little of it? And that's really, I think, where it went wrong is they could have set themselves up for a franchise. And they didn't seem to do that. It was like, let's just get everything Daredevil into one movie. And they didn't leave much room for anything else. And they didn't do any of it well. Where if they gave it a chance to breathe, and actually played on, they started to play on some of Matt's issues and stuff like that, never really got there. So that was that's really my issue with the film, was that piece. And I actually agree with Paul. I was surprised that I enjoyed watching Trial of the Incredible Hulk more.
Tina, I think this, I mean, there's so many problems. I was going to say, you know, that the biggest problem is casting. And I think that is the biggest problem. I think the casting was a big problem. But I think the script, for exactly the reasons that you just went over, Sean, was also a big problem. Mm-hmm. And I think that the directing was a problem because, again, I think they tried to make him a superhero instead of just a hero.
Yeah.
And I know he has a superpower with his radar sense and all of that. And you can play with that and, you know, make him a superhero for that reason. But they made him where he, you know, when he's leaping around, he's practically flying. It's not possible to do what he's doing in this movie. And I had a problem with that. And the biggest thing I had before I get into the details of the cast and all of that, the biggest problem I had was the playground scene where he's squaring off against Elektra. And it's more like they're dancing than fighting. And I really just remember like thinking this is comically bad.
It fell into a lot of the 90s traps.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yep.
It's a really 2003 movie, but
it's a 90s film.
Still is, and that was really one of the things that stood out for this one, and it feels exceptionally dated.
I think Ben Affleck did a he did a decent job of trying to play the part, but I think he was miscast. And I remember even when they announced the casting, I thought, because he and Matt Damon are like best friends. They wrote Good Will Hunting together and all of that. And I remember saying at the time, boy, I think Matt Damon looks the part a lot more than Ben Affleck does. And I think it would have been better with him. And it said he was actually offered the role and rejected it.
Probably because he read the script.
Well, according to Wikipedia, it said he claimed that he and Ben loved that comic book, but I just didn't quite believe in the script or the director at the time.
I think he made
a good call.
Well, if you look at Matt Damon's career, not always, but for the most part, he makes good choices. Not everything, but most of the films he's done. And this is definitely one of those. I'm not as down on Affleck as you are for this, Paul. When I went to see the film, and I remember being like Sean was within minutes, I was like, oh no, this is not good. Like you could tell almost right away that the tone was off. And Sean had a great point. It is so evocative of that bad 90s superhero film. The way it looked, like everything was just off. And for me, the script was painfully bad. I thought the only character they really got was Favreau as Foggy. Like I liked his, but the jokes he was making and their rapport, everything was off. Everything. Who played Bullseye? I'm sorry, I should know this. Colin Farrell, who's a great actor. And he was definitely having fun with what they gave him. It was fun, like he killed the woman on the plane with the peanut and all that, all that stuff. But
that was one of the highlight moments.
Yeah, that was a highlight scene, but because that was like that's like the psychopathy of Bullseye. But in general, I really didn't feel like I was watching Bullseye. And was it Tiny Zeus Lister as the Kingpin?
No, it was Michael Clarke Duncan.
I'm sorry. Another fine actor, but it was just atrocious. It wasn't the Kingpin. It was it not for one moment that I feel intimidation, or this sort of this mystique that character should have. He was just a thug, pretty much in a suit.
That's like, the one area where I'm going to disagree with you slightly. Excuse me. I remember thinking that. My first thought is when they take a white character and have a black actor play him, I have to say, is there anything intrinsically about this character that requires you to not change races? And I don't think there is. So I was fine with the fact that they had a black
actor doing it.
And I thought physically he looked the part. I thought, he looked the way he's drawn in the comic book, very large and, but in an expensive suit. I thought he had the basic intimidating appearance. I don't think the character was well written, but I thought he did have the appearance, and his voice is, threatening. So I really didn't have a problem with his casting as much as I did the way he was written.
Well, I agree in that for this whole movie, everything comes back to, the reason why I'm so discontented with it is the way it was written. Especially for the Kingpin, and also Elektra. And I loved Alias. I think Jennifer Garner is a fine actor, but Elektra has a certain quality that is intangible, almost ethereal, almost like she's almost like a mystical being, exotic. None of that was there. Like none of it. Not for one moment that I think this is Elektra. It's not because she wasn't Greek. I mean, fine, but it just the character should be almost like an otherworldly character who you almost like Matt just wants her so badly, and like she's almost kind of always out of reach, and that I just thought they totally missed the boat on the way they, again, we come back to the same theme, the script, in the way that they rendered her. And like you said, Paul, and I couldn't agree more, they jammed so much Daredevil mythos into this, I don't know, was it an hour and a half, 2 hours at the most? And it just, there were all these parts kind of rubbing up against each other, and it just, nothing was working well. I mean, to go back to Sean's point, the director's cut, at least you see Matt being a lawyer a little bit more, which, he kind of really should have in a movie about Daredevil, which They don't really have much in the theatrical cut. This is it's an atrocious film. It's so bad.
I'm gonna disagree with you slightly again on Jennifer Garner, which I think she was terribly miscast. But I do think the fact that she wasn't, she didn't necessarily have to be Greek, but I did think she needed to have that European flavor about her. Whereas Jennifer Garner comes off as the all-American girl. So I just don't think she fit.
That's a fair point, Paul. I was just trying to be a little merciful, but you know, that's a fair point too.
I think she is a very, you know, she's a very attractive girl. She's a good actor. There's nothing wrong with her. She just doesn't fit this part.
No, I'm assuming they read the source material, but whether it was budget constraints or just the talent level, the people they had making the movie, they just couldn't capture that character.
It felt like they had like a script for an action movie and they were like putting in pieces.
Yeah.
Just to stick them in there. I found myself with this viewing, cause I ended up watching Elektra too. Just because I'm like, let's see what my memories about that one were. Right. And I flashed on through and when watching Elektra, I kind of had this brainstorm. I'm like, I wonder how I would have felt about these movies if instead of them trying to make them a Daredevil and Elektra movie, if they had created just original characters and stopped trying to force in this lore that just didn't seem to fit in this film, would I have felt the same way? Because the acting talent that was in both of these were very solid acting. They did a really nice job with like seeking out talented people for these roles. It just didn't work.
No.
And I think that's the piece I felt. It feels like somebody was like saying, okay, we got this action film. Now let's plug this Daredevil piece in here, this Daredevil piece in there, this piece of Elektra's history in here. And when we kill Elektra, we're going to do this right here. And everything was just jammed in. Without the breathing room. It doesn't help that like we've got a Netflix series and a Disney Plus series to talk about that gave a lot of breathing room to this stuff.
I don't think that truly is influencing what any of us are saying about this, because I'm pretty sure we all had these same feelings before the Netflix series was ever made.
Agreed.
So I don't think we're looking at it and saying, well, now that I've seen the Netflix series, oh, this is bad. I think we thought it was bad when it came out.
But I'm saying now in my rewatch, I was like sitting there going, oh my gosh, I've seen this now with breathing room. And it made it stand out for me more that there was so much crammed into this, which I don't know that I was conscious of back when my first viewing came through, but this time around, I was really conscious over how much they were trying to do in the film. And I think that's part of where it falls apart. Too much of the Daredevil lore shoved into this one did not help it.
And I thought terribly miscasting of a good actor was Joe Pantoliano as Ben Urich.
I was going to mention that. Yep.
Ben Urich should be a little older, world weary, but very, very seasoned, and he knows what he's doing, and you could see that his mind is working at all times, and you know that there's a certain presence that he should have. Meanwhile, you know, Joe Pantoliano comes off as half a wise guy,
and they shove in the discovery of the identity.
Yep.
Like again, that was another thing that like we speed round it, like that couldn't have been Daredevil 2. You know, I mean, it felt like they were trying to get everything in because they had no confidence there would be a second Daredevil.
Well, and that was borne out by what they actually produced.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I agree, Paul. It's nothing to do with what's come recently on Netflix and Disney. I mean, this is, but so 2003. So at this point, we've had the Batman series. Mm-hmm. That's mixed. I think we all have different views on that. But, you know, I think we all agree the first one was a magnificent, especially for when it came out, adaptation of, I think, the Batman mythos as we know it in the comics in many ways. So there was some, you know, precedent that maybe they might pull this off. Certainly by 2003, they had advanced more in terms of special effects to some degree, certainly further than, you know, the Trial of the Incredible Hulk. But it just, again, I'm a broken record. These scripts are just bad. Like that, they don't. Whoever's writing them, they just don't. Maybe they're being pressured by other corporate concerns. What they can and cannot do, I don't know. I can't answer that. But it just when I watched the movie, I remember just within minutes going, "Oh, this is not good." And just it just got worse and worse for the most part as it went along until the end. I was like, just get me out of here. And then 5 years later with Iron Man, they started to kind of figure out, you know, how they're going to do it. Then Spider-Man, of course, had been very successful too. But again, like the thing about the Raimi films, like that was a director who understood the source material. And that was very evident in those scripts, especially, I mean, the third one I don't think was very good, but the first two. But the third one, like go back to Sean's point, not to get too much into Spider-Man, but they were jamming a ton of stuff in there in that movie too, in that third Spider-Man film. Whenever they try to do too much, usually it doesn't work very well.
I think the poster child for that, if we're going to pair you off of this, is Green Lantern.
Mm-hmm.
They, oof. You know.
Oof.
Yeah, okay. So just trying to, you know, again, move this along a little bit because I don't want to go too long on this. Anything else on this film that you think is worth noting?
Just like Sean's point, I mean, if you're a completist, the director's cut, if you have like an afternoon where like you have nothing else to do in your life and you won't feel like you've lost a couple hours and you'll feel that you feel really bitter about that, put the director's cut in. It's an interesting timepiece. Let's just leave it at that.
So, you know, when we rate these movies, sometimes I think back to years ago when I was watching Siskel and Ebert, and they were doing
the movies.
They were doing their 10 worst movies of the year, and they started off with an explanation. Basically, they gave an asterisk to it, and they said, you know, we could find 10 low budget piece of crap movies to say that these are the worst movies of the year, and who could argue with us? But what we try to do is we try to find movies that are bad but should have been better, you know. And this movie feels like the poster child for that. This movie had the potential, it had the budget, it had big name actors, it had, you know, it had a good story to tell, and it failed on almost every level. So for that reason, I'm going to say this one is one of the rare movies that I rank as a Jaws 4.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, this is a Jaws 4 for me, and I was trying to think it through. And that's even with the director's cut version of it. And I have, like, no urge to watch this again. It's not like I'm sitting here going, like, it's time I never get back and that type of thing. I'm not in that place, but I've watched it for this. I would watch it again if there was, in the future, some conversation that we were going to have around this film that made it worth watching for the conversation. But that would be the only reason why I'd watch it. And I'm a comic fan that's pretty easy to get on the hook of saying, like, I want to watch something from comic history. This would be something I would actually steer somebody away from saying, if you want to know a little bit about Daredevil, don't watch this. Because this will not be a good introduction for somebody into the world of Daredevil if they've never experienced it before. So
no, this is the completest one. If you feel yes. like you need to see everything, and no other reason to see it beyond besides that, honestly,
and you realize you don't.
So, in 2015, we got the Netflix series. Now, Netflix, you know, I think they were pretty bold in what they did. They did the Daredevil series. They did Luke Cage, not Power Man. They did Iron Fist. They did
Jessica Jones.
Jennifer Jones is the old-time actress. And then they did The Defenders. Daredevil had his own series, and they also did The Punisher, excuse me. Daredevil had 3 seasons on Netflix, plus he was in The Defenders. Now, I think The Defenders, honestly, we could set that aside. I'd really just want to talk about the 3 seasons.
It's fine.
The first season was kind of the origin and his battle with Kingpin. The second season was him and the Punisher with the Kingpin overtones. And the third season was him and Bullseye with the Kingpin overtones. I ate this series up. I thought, I mean, if I have to go season-wise, I think the third season was the best one, then followed by the first season, then the second. But they were all awesome as far as I was concerned. The casting was great. The scripts were great. There were moments where you probably could have chopped a little away and had maybe 10 or 11 episodes instead of 13 in the season. But other than that, I really can't criticize this series at all. I just think they hit it on the money. What'd you guys think?
Go ahead, Sean.
I remember watching the first episode. I've got a bust, actually, of Daredevil from the first season because I got so into it that I wanted swag. I've still got it. It's a prized treasure of mine. I think one of the things we're highlighting here is it's so rare that we get the ones that nail it. And I feel like this did a great job of just taking the risk of just trying to get it right. Yep. One of the things I think it does very well is it doesn't feel like it has to follow the exact pace of the comics. I know that might seem like a weird thing to say, but I think when you're doing a TV show, you want to get the lore right and you want to make it work for the media that you're in. And I felt like it did that, but it also didn't feel like this overwhelming need to unnecessarily mess with and change things that worked in the original source material. Tonally, it did such a great job of grabbing it right. We actually just got done talking about something that pulled in a lot of great acting talent, but cast them wrong. This did a great job of pulling in great acting talent and cast them right, which is one of the things. It did something that I like in Smallville, where the Kingpin story was incredibly compelling. The relationship with Vanessa was incredibly compelling. And we've talked in this episode about when you get the villain wrong or when the villain's not super interesting, it takes something away. What it was is you were invested in the villain. And there were times where I was kind of hoping he didn't turn. But I liked how it was, we never lost Wilson Fisk in the fact that we had this interesting relationship with them and we got to see his humanity and his vulnerabilities. There's so much that this just did right in it. And I feel like those foundational pieces set it on a course where you could do 3 seasons of this and just nail it. And from the foundational beginnings of it straight on through, you wanted to see when characters came back. You wanted to see their story when they were finally back on screen. It was something where they just really understood the pacing and how to do arcs. Because this was filled with comic book style arcs that I think just really worked well.
Well, I mean, I concur hardly. I mean, in contrast to what we're talking about previously, the script writers for this show, they clearly understood the source material, revered the source material, and they went right to the essence of the characters. There was never any retreat from that source material in terms of trying to sand down, for lack of a better term, like comic book edges. They are embracing all of that. And like Paul said, the casting was ideally suited to the characters that were being rendered by the script. I mean, Charlie Cox is Matt Murdock. Mm-hmm. I think he is just, he clearly understands the character. He has the complete look of the character. Like when you imagine Matt Murdock out of the comic, I see him. Like he, like the way he carries himself, the kind of style of glasses he's wearing, sort of his dry sense of humor. They just fully understood the character and he understands the character as he plays him. Karen and Foggy are pitch perfect. They're the relationship, the dynamic. But for me, what really makes the show as good as it is Vincent D'Onofrio as Fisk. When he first appeared, and I mean, he's a pretty big guy in real life. It's not like he's a small man, like he's a big guy. But he's also a tremendous actor in that he transforms himself. I mean, part of like he's bald, of course, but he clearly understands the kingpin that Miller and Klaus Janson created in those stories. And when he appeared on screen, he starts to talk. And I remember my wife, I mean, she's not really comics, but she was watching the show with me and she knows a little bit about it. And she looked at me and she said, he's terrifying. And I said, yep. And in many cases, he's not even really doing that much. He's sitting at a desk or he's talking in a very like low tone, but he radiates such utter menace. And when he does get violent, I mean, the first season when he basically beheads the guy in the car door. And I remember jumping up like, I mean, it was horrible, but like with glee, because like, oh, they've got it. Like like the Kingpin is a monster, but for the most part, he tries to maintain this facade of like, I'm the legitimate businessman. Like I'm bringing the underworld with me into the legitimate world, but he can never fully leave behind what enabled this power base, which besides his Machiavellian brilliance is that he's a stone cold killer. And when they show, like they don't have him do violence too much. A lot of times it's him just kind of plotting, but when they have him be violent, it's so horrifying. And this show does not pull any punches on the display of lines. I want to ask you guys something. The thing that really showed me on the show was, I think it was the first episode, when he has to rescue the kid from the Russian mob, right? And he has the Miller, like, man without fear outfit that he puts on. He puts the black, you know, the scarf over his face and so forth.
The Rex Smith Trial of the Incredible Hulk outfit.
Yeah, yeah, but just... better, but yes. but A Man Without Fear hadn't come out yet when they did I don't think it had. If I remember correctly, I think Without Fear was the 90s.
You're right.
No,
right.
It did not.
But what I loved was when they show you that, yes, Daredevil is a great warrior, but to be Daredevil and to fight like that is so difficult. Like they just show you how brutally hard it is for him to get involved in these Donnybrooks with these guys. I think it's one of the first times we've seen a comic adaptation where they really show you the cost to actually fight like that, uh-huh. and what it does to him. Because again, like Paul said, his power, I mean, he has his senses, but otherwise, basically, he's a trained ninja and, you know, a boxer and all that. And like by the end of that fight, like he is totally exhausted and just totally beaten up. And I was like, oh, this is one of the best things I've seen in terms of adaptations.
Yeah, the fight scenes are, you know, it's funny because there was such criticism over the Iron Fist fight scenes that they didn't appear to be real.
You mean like when he was beaten up by like a guard in a warehouse?
Yes.
And he's like, perhaps one of the greatest martial arts, besides, you know, Shang-Chi on my shirt here.
But the fight scenes in Daredevil all seem to be so well choreographed that they seem totally realistic. I mean, they are, I'm sure, taking some liberties with, you know, the number of punches to the face you could take and still get up. But just the same, they all feel totally realistic. And there's a visceral feeling of the power of the punches and everything that's going on, which goes to the directing in this show. Back to Vincent D'Onofrio that you were talking about. I think he is so three-dimensional in this show that it's even more so than years of comic books showing his history. I just feel that like you really feel like he's just so real, and he's a fully realized character with his OCD and his hair temper trigger temper and his history with his father that they give us.
Yeah.
There's just so much meat on the bone there, and he is a terrifying character. And the fact that he's been able to maintain this through now four seasons, we're going to get to Born Again, but he's been able to maintain this without ever you having a moment where you feel like, okay, now he's been brought down. Even when he's defeated, he's still very, very threatening.
Well, think about, did you watch Echo?
I did not.
Okay, well then I don't want to spoil that because he plays a major role in that series too. You should watch Echo, Paul, because it does really fit into what's happening in Daredevil right now, actually. Mm-hmm. But I for all the characters they've done now in the MCU, I think his performance is one of the greatest adaptations of any of the characters, because what Miller and Janssen established, and I agree with you, he's taken it even further. Out of all the characters that I've been watching, I've enjoyed to varying degrees, there's no one I enjoy more than when he's done his performance of that character. I actually find it awe-inspiring.
I'm going to also give kudos to Charlie Cox for very similar reasons. We talked about cost, the physical cost, but one of the things I think Charlie Cox has nailed in this one is the emotional cost of being Daredevil. And I think it's something bold that this series has done, because they've managed to take him to the darkest depths, but not lose the fact that we want to see him rise up.
Exactly.
It's very hard to go as far as they've gone with him over those three seasons and still make you like him, like still make you want to see him rise up and succeed. They've gone to some really sketchy places, and it's stuff that's comic book accurate, where, you know, there's points in time where he's not treating the people closest to him, who we love, very well at all, and it's having a negative toll on them. We're seeing the consequences and costs of being a friend of Matt Murdock,
and that's
and being in a relationship of any sort with Daredevil through multiple cast members. And it's something that I think is just a victory in this, because it's just a next level.
That's a great point, Sean, because as you said, you know, they really do go into that in the comic, the cost of his double life to both him and to the people who love him. Born Again, of course, probably the consummate example of that, but in the comics. But like in the show, like think about his relationship with Karen, which is deeply problematic because they clearly love each other. But, you know, there's even a moment, I don't remember which season it was, where they actually even go out on some dates and looks like it's going to go somewhere. But then, you know, it's totally derailed. And she's
the second season, and it's derailed because Elektra.
Right. And she's wonderful. In the role as Karen, Charlie Cox, like when they do the whole thing with like his mother and all the key elements. But to go back to your point, Sean, this is over four seasons. They didn't jam everything into one couple movies, so you're getting so much more out of the character and that essence that we all just love going back to reading the books. I must say though. Because Paul just mentioned it, I was a little disappointed with Elektra in the second season.
I don't think they've ever fully hit
the character yet. They haven't. But she
was better than Jennifer Garner.
Yes, definitely that. Definitely so. But certainly, like looked more like what you would imagine Elektra to look. I just feel like the star of that season was the storyline with the Punisher, and I just felt like they just still really hadn't fully gotten it yet. Maybe they were trying to do a little too much there. I don't know, but it just didn't feel
100%. I would say that the problem I thought with the Elektra casting wasn't her as Elektra so much as I didn't feel the chemistry between her and Charlie Cox, mm-hmm. where again, good he's point. Supposed to be obsessed with her and he's supposed to be just totally, you know, wrapped up and wrapped.
I mean, the comic, he's digging up her body.
Yeah, and I didn't feel that chemistry, and I thought that's where the character fell short in the series. Yeah. But otherwise, in the fight scenes or whatever, she seemed fine to me.
Yeah, the combat scenes in all these seasons are exceptional. It's, I mean,
and she did have that exotic feel about her.
Yeah,
no, Jennifer Garner didn't.
What the comic did better was establish a history with them.
Yes.
We got to see it and we got to feel it. So that way, when she came back, there was something there that we cared about that like really mattered. I don't think this did a very good job of establishing that this was this long lost love. And what you're left with is like, why isn't he obsessed with Karen?
Yeah.
The competition in the comic during that time for Elektra was not very strong because he was
Heather
already Glenn. Being horrible.
Or Heather Glenn. Yeah.
He was being horrible to her.
Yeah.
But well, on the other side of that coin, I do think they nailed the character of Stick.
Yes.
Oh, Scott Glenn, of course. Yeah.
That's what he wonderful. Was perfect. In the
wonderful. Part. Wonderful. And,
you know, it's funny because, you know, I first became aware of Scott Glenn when he was in Silverado in 1980.
I love Silverado. 85, I think. Yep.
And I thought, this guy's an up-and-coming, he's going to be a star. And if you take it 20 years later and you see him playing Stick, this old beat-up guy who's, you know, like totally just like, almost like shriveled up. It's hard to believe it's the same actor, but boy, did he ever nail this part.
He sure did.
Perfect in this show. And it did give you some history there. The problem was, with some of that history, as far as him and Elektra, it's tell you, not show you. If they had shown us, I think we would have felt the chemistry more instead of just telling us.
I think ideally Elektra should have been her own season because they could have done a whole season go like as Miller did where he gives you the whole backstory. And yet, like Sean said, you really feel for their young love. And, you know that's like the first love for both of them. So that's overwhelming and all that meant for the characters. Which is why when they start fighting in the comic as Daredevil Electra, it's heartbreaking. And you know, maybe they were just trying to do too much. And I mean, it's still to the audience, it's definitely still worth watching the second season. It's just, there's a lot going on in it. And maybe I would have preferred Electra be her own. They could have done the whole story. I mean, I think the second season, don't they show the hand in the second season? Right. Yes. Uh-huh. And I remember and what was thrilling was they show you, I remember a hand assassin like attacks him like in his apartment, I think, and he's got like the chain and the hook, and the guy like walked right out of the comic, like he had the red ninja robe. Like I was like, whoa, this is awesome! Like they really, like, but that's where the show is not afraid, and you see this more and more now. These adaptations is not afraid to really go to the source material and just show it to you. I think it works more than it doesn't. So.
And even to have little things in there that just, you know, it's I wouldn't even go as far as say Easter eggs, but just things as a comic fan that you're going to look at and say, oh yeah, look what they did. Having the gladiator in there.
Yeah. You know,
things like that. It was just awesome. And then I thought, what's his name? Wilson, I can't think of his name. The actor that played the Punisher, John Bernthal.
Yeah. Great actor.
I thought his acting was perfect. I think the director could have framed shots a little bit better just to give him a little bit more of a physical presence, because he looked a little smallish in some scenes, and I think he needed to be more physically imposing looking. That was the only criticism I could have of that.
I guess it depends on how you want your Punisher, because, you know, in the comic, you imagine the Punisher is a pretty large man. I didn't mind that as much, but only because I think Bernthal is one of the great actors working today in film and television. And the voice he created for the character and the way he carried himself. I mean, this is not in this season, but in his own show, I remember this one scene. Did you guys see the Punisher series?
Yes.
The two seasons where he's going to execute this kiddie porn guy. And he tells the girl with him, like, you know, he says, like, leave. And he puts the gun up to the guy's chest. And he doesn't kill him ultimately because the girl begs him not to. He is so freaking intimidating in that scene. And, like, John Bernthal is not, like, a huge man, right? But he's a great actor. And that makes up for a lot. Not always. I mean, there are times where you're like, you know, as much as I like Michael Keaton, never for a minute that I believe, like, he's really physically Batman. But I still loved him in the part. But yeah, like I think the casting, this show to me is the perfect synthesis of the right casting, and the script is just on target, and the actors understand and appreciate what they're bringing from the page to the screen.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think Bernthal brought the perfect acting tone to the part. I just thought, you know, when they were framing shots, they could
have made
him just look a little bit physically, more physically imposing. That's the only thing I would have changed. And I thought, again, the character had depth to him. Every character had depth, in my opinion, even the ones who were just kind of throw-ins. You know, the owl had a part.
Oh, the owl, great.
He was great. And you know, the gladiator was in there, and he was great. And, you know, there were just so many little things in here that just made this series just a pleasure to watch. And after three seasons, they canceled it. And I couldn't believe that they did that. But clearly it was a case of just finances, because there was nothing quality-wise that made them have to cancel this show.
Well, you reminded me also of when you talk about even the throwaway characters. Like, they took Wesley, who was the Kingpin simpering lieutenant from Born Again, and they made him to like his only friend in this version. He's a far more formidable figure in this. And, you know, the scene where Karen shoots him is so traumatizing, and just how she has to carry that. I love how, like, a good Daredevil story, everyone is burdened by guilt, because that's a big part of the character. And, you know, they really explore that in different ways with all these characters. I mean, let me ask you the guys this, because we're talking about the different performances. I thought Bullseye was unbelievable in that third season. The scene where he puts on Daredevil's, by the way, I think the Daredevil costume, I think overall is well done. What do you guys, before, what do you think of the costume? Because obviously it's a combination of like armor and like a bodysuit, but what do you think?
I thought the costume was perfect, to be honest with you. It kind of played on the traditional Daredevil costume and then the armor that they had done in the comics for a while.
Yeah.
But they did it right as far as I was concerned. The only thing about it that I can criticize at all, I was talking to Glenn Greenberg, who actually appeared on Back to the Bins shortly before this episode was recorded. And he said to me, the biggest disappointment for him for season three was Bullseye wears the Daredevil costume more than Matt Murdock does.
Yeah. Well,
I can agree with that.
I was going to say that, and this is why this show was so good. It was not afraid of the noir source material that Miller and Jansen established and how brutally violent the comic was, which is a necessary part, I think, of that story. When he puts on the Daredevil costume and he goes into that office building, just basically kills everybody in that office building. It is a utterly horrifying sequence, but they really got that character, like not only his abilities, but also just how completely deranged he is. But they also made him kind of sympathetic in a way too. The situation with the girl he was like, and how the Kingpin manipulated that. Really good.
They made him three dimensional.
Yeah, they made him because you did. Yeah. Because the comic, I mean, Bullseye, I mean, is a great visual villain. And, you know, he's obsessed with Daredevil. But the Bullseye they put in the TV show, there's a lot more layers there.
Well, I think you can compare Colin Farrell, who's an excellent actor, and his performance as Bullseye to Bullseye in this. And the difference
that was a cartoon.
The script just didn't give Colin Farrell the depth or the motivation or the characterization that this show did. And this show just, you know, made him a terrifying character.
Yep.
And one that, you know, obviously you couldn't relate to him like, oh yeah, I would do that. You know, you couldn't.
But he wasn't, was a human being, and
you could understand where he was coming from. You couldn't agree with it, but you could understand it.
The costume I felt was comic book inspired in all of the right ways. It's an example, I think, for people trying to create these shows or these movies that they should really build off of. The idea that not every costume has to be 100% comic book accurate. And I thought they did a great job of recognizing how do we make this look cool in the real world? And without losing what makes it a Daredevil costume.
And I agree, they got it.
And that is something that I just think they nailed. I think it's a good looking costume. It looks functional. It looks protective, but yet it looks like he should be able to move around in it versus I'm a Batman geek. And there's some of those Batman costumes where it's like, how is he still alive? Because he can't move. I think that's one of those ones where you got to rely on the suspension of disbelief. The costume is functional. Bullseye, one of the things that I think they nailed, and I agree that I wanted to see Daredevil don the costume, but I think you're supposed to that season. And the reason being is because it took one of my favorite bits from Born Again, where we're doing this smear campaign, and Matt is not in a place to do anything about it because he has fallen so far, and we get to see him. It actually, the villain's providing the motivation for us as the viewer to want to see Matt get it together. So that way we can eventually see the inevitable showdown that we all want to see. And I love that it wasn't super clean. It felt dirty and violent and all the right pieces. It worked really, really well. Bullseye was just great casting in this.
Yes. By the way, Sean, Paul, go ahead.
I was just saying, for that reason, the Bullseye character really made the third season my favorite of the three.
Three and one are neck and neck for me, I must say. Three floored me. I want to mention, go back to something Sean brought before I forget, because you mentioned Ben Urich before, Sean. That was my only disappointment in this show, that they killed him so quickly. I mean, the scene where the Kingpin killed him was a riveting scene. But the Matt-Ben relationship is so special in the comic. I was kind of hoping they would further that more in the show. I mean, they just went their own way with it, of course. But I was just, what did you guys think about that?
I wanted to see them play out the relationship where Ben eventually discovers it and has to wrestle with it. Because I think a TV show would have been a great way to show happening over multiple episodes where he's ready to tell the truth, but then doesn't. And I think that was something that could have been played in this. I think looking over the three seasons, I don't know where you would have put it. I think that the show would have benefited from, I think with Elektra, I think we're seeing ways that this show could have been a four season show very easily. And you could have done something really cool with Ben, and you could have made adjustments to Elektra that I think would have been a little bit more satisfying. So that would have required though an additional season for any of that to happen, because we need some breathing space for both of those things. Yeah. So I say that I want it. I just don't know where I would have put it in what we've gotten in these three seasons.
Well, her niece is in the new season. His niece, I should say, Ben's niece.
Maybe.
True. I thought that I was disappointed that they killed him off, because I enjoyed his character. I thought his character fit the series well. So I would have liked to have seen some more of that interaction that you're talking about. But I thought it was so well played that I accepted it as a necessity.
Yeah, I mean, it's the way he died, and like D'Onofrio just sitting in his apartment. And what makes that scene especially chilling is like the Kingpin, he's there initially to have a conversation with him. Ben's like, all right, we'll talk, fine. And you're like, all right, is he going to kill him or not? And then like the way D'Onofrio can just turn, and one second he's disgusted, the next minute he's on him and he's strangling him. Like, it again, just the most terrifying villain in any of these adaptations.
The way D'Onofrio played that scene, I was left with the impression that the Kingpin was there and didn't even know he was going to kill him.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Until he decided to.
Yeah.
Walking Dead did this sometimes, where they veered off the comic book to surprise the comic fans. I think the one thing that I'll give them for taking that choice with Ben was I cared about him so because of the actor.
Oh, yeah.
I cared about him so deeply in his story and his story with his wife. I cared about him so deeply at that point. I thought he was safe. And when they did it, it was like, oh no.
Yeah.
And it also showed that like, we're going to play with the rules a little bit.
And that, when it's well done, I like to see when they take risks like that. Yep.
Yeah.
And when they do things like that, it gives some weight to the threat. Now, you know, nobody is safe.
Nobody's safe. Exactly.
So I can't give enough superlatives to this three seasons. I just thought it was so well done. I recently rewatched it and enjoyed it every bit as much as I did the first time I saw it. So it holds up to second viewing. The acting is awesome. The directing is awesome. The scripts are awesome. And the casting is awesome. I got to give this a Jaws. As far as TV series go, it's a Jaws.
Oh, God, yeah. Without question.
Easily a Jaws, because there's a lot of investment to rewatching a TV series.
Yes.
I'd watch it again. I want to watch it. I want to watch it a third time. And I think that's something where like the excitement of just being able to see more of this is great. So yeah, easy Jaws. If you haven't watched this, do yourself a favor. You have to watch this series. Anything we may have spoiled for you in this, the execution will more than make up for it.
And because it stood up to a second viewing so well, I know spoilers can't ruin it, because I knew everything that was going to happen, and it was still excellent. And it was very disappointing when they canceled it. I have to say, of the Netflix series, I thought this was by far the best one. I think they had some other good things. There were moments in Luke Cage that I thought were very good.
I was a big Jessica Jones fan myself.
I thought the Jessica Jones, especially the first season of Jessica Jones, was chilling. Of great moments. Yeah, Purple Man I talk about another villain that was just so well portrayed. Just great stuff, but Iron Fist was a little bit of a letdown. And then when they finally got them together and they did the Defenders, that was a letdown. So that kind of softened the blow of the cancellation a little bit, because I wasn't sure where they would go and what they would be able to do that would be as good as these three seasons at that moment. But I was going to find out this year.
What I thought was good, though, in terms of transitional moments. So two things I'd mention. When he appears briefly in the last Spider-Man film, and he's acting as a lawyer and he's consulting and he catches the Rock.
Yes.
It's just like a quick cameo, but Matt Murdock is also really cool. Like I've had various female friends who like have read some of the books and they're all like in love with him. And he has this like, he's a very damaged person, but there's also something enormously attractive about it. I remember in the classic Bendis run, Jessica Jones is hired as her bodyguard. And she's like, and I remember one scene, she's thinking to herself, oh crap, I've been falling in love with Matt Murdock. So he has this quality. And I think Cox captures that really well. The other thing to piggyback on that, when he appears in She-Hulk, and they're kind of riffing on like the more swashbuckling Daredevil of the Silver Age. He's got the different costume. He's more got more of a swashbuckling attitude. I love that they did that because they kind of incorporated both elements of the character, like the Silver Age and also the Mark Waid Daredevil. And then like Cox can play both. And really the full Daredevil character, he's both of those things, because when he's out there being a gymnast around the city, and I mean, he obviously loves doing that, and he enjoys the feeling of that experience, but he's also a deeply tormented man who has tremendous Catholic guilt. And there's that element of, they had the one that in the show too. But I like how they tried to reconcile all those, because he's a complex character, both in the comic, and then they really captured that with Cox's performance in these various films and television.
So I'm sure you guys were as happy as I was when they announced that they were going to do a series of Born Again. Now, I knew going into it that it wasn't going to be a strict adaptation of the Born Again.
No, it's just the title, basically. It's their own thing.
But you know what? I think it's more than just the title, because it does have the sense of the Kingpin, you know, trying to bring him down. And he knows his identity, and he has this information, and he's going to go after him. But they're not rushing to it. In fact, they spent the whole first season, and he still hasn't really totally torn him down yet. So I'm wondering, is it, because we know there's going to be two seasons. Maybe there's going to be more than that, because I think they're definitely slow playing this, and I think it's to its benefit that they
absolutely
slow play it. And I think it could go 3 or 4 seasons easily.
Well, they're also incorporating the Zdarsky run where the Kingpin becomes the mayor, which I haven't fully read that run yet. I have the omnibus, I haven't fully read it yet. I'm not going to get overly political, but they're all this season is also clearly influenced by what's going on inside our country right now. I think it's fair to say that Kingpin is an analog for a certain someone in many ways. Oh, I think the Kingpin is a much smarter person, but so I think there's political overtones to this as well. That and like, you know, a lot of the great Marvel comics, sometimes hand-handed, sometimes more skillfully, would try to comment on things going on in the real world. I think that's part of this story too. But I think you have a good point, Paul, that they could very well develop that. Please go 3 or 4 seasons. I'd eat that up. Go ahead, Sean.
I'm glad that they aren't feeling the need to redo some of the elements of Born Again that they did very well in the Netflix series.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they did in season 3, they were taking a lot of things from Born Again, especially with the bullseye sequences we mentioned. I don't want them to, because they rehash his origin in this in a way that if there's one criticism I actually have of Born Again, I'm like, I don't know why you needed to play. So I didn't need the dad to be Daredevil. You know, as far as in that piece, it's a minor nitpick and very minor, but it was something like, I thought the origin was really well done in the Netflix piece. We could have done a short version of that and then just moved along, because you want to establish it for new viewers. And I actually appreciate the attempt. I was like, I don't know that I needed you to throw that in there as like some kind of inspiration for why he was called Daredevil. But other than that, I like that. I wanted Born Again because of the title, and I'm glad that they didn't feel the need to pull in elements, because I don't know how you're going to do it better. So do what they're doing. Take the elements that you haven't done yet and tell a different story. And there's so much to do with the character, and tonally, it's great to see Charlie Cox back. It's great to see Vincent D'Onofrio back. The woman who's playing Vanessa, I'm not trying to butcher her name, because, you know, I'm looking at it, But she's somebody who I loved in the original series because of the fact that she starts off as being somebody who seems so good, and yet you see how when they found each other, there was some kismet there between them that continues to bring itself back. I loved the roller coaster of the relationship in this season between the two of them. And there's something about that casting that just worked really well and continues to be leveraged. This is an example of them looking back, really embracing what worked in that series and not trying to break it. And I appreciated that.
I think her character is extremely solid. I think you do feel a chemistry between her and D'Onofrio in their
portrayals. Oh, without question.
And she comes off as, you know, she's I can't even say she's willing to take the back seat to him, but she's willing to placate him often. But you could see she's not just this cipher who's following along with him. Her mind is constantly working, and she's occasionally manipulating him.
Oh, without question. Yeah.
And just, you know, doing her own backdoor deals and things, so that she's another one that's another three-dimensional character, which I just love this, the fact of that stuff. And the other thing, just quickly about this series, that it, you know, we talked about saying how there's real stakes. We have two characters die in this season
that I
never saw coming. God. Spoilers, anybody who's listening who hasn't watched it yet, you might want to shut this off, watch the season and get back. But the deaths of Foggy and the White Tiger are just, like, both of them are so unexpected when they happen that it's just amazing. I'm fully expecting the White Tiger to get arrested and put in jail and made an example of, and boom, he's gone. That like shocked me when it happened.
I was glad they gave time passage after that too. And Matt had established a new way of operating, a new law firm, and I put some pieces back in play that you'd want to see. I liked that Karen was, especially with what had been done with her in the first three seasons, Karen was kind of out at that point. I was glad not permanently, though, because I think she does such a terrific job as Karen. And I don't know, well, we heard all kinds of rumors in the beginning as far as her not being involved, and then they brought her back in. I was glad to see her not only in the beginning, but then come back again. And I think it was at the right time for her to come back again, because I really like her, and I like the chemistry with her and the Punisher, but also the chemistry with her and Matt. Charlie Cox and her have a chemistry there that you believe the relationship, and it's something about the acting talent. And again, casting is key. And it's not just how great the acting talent is. It's them being cast in the right way to match the writing of the roles. And boy, did they do that with those two.
Well, think about, to piggyback on that, Sean, when they meet in the courthouse and the trauma that they're sharing over the loss of Foggy, and she's like, she can't even really, like, they can't really fully talk to each other. Like, the writing and the acting that scene is so well done, because you really believe the history between the two characters and how this trauma, this mutual trauma, has so adversely affected their ability just to even communicate at that point. And like you said, Sean, it's great that she comes back to the end of the season, because at the end of the day, Karen is really one of Matt's anchors in his entire life. I mean, she understands him in a way I think very few other characters, comic or this world, do. So
it makes the show work on two different levels too, because you gotta take this show and go, okay, there's going to be an audience of potentially watching this that did not watch those first three seasons and may not have a long history with Daredevil. So they establish through, you know, this thing happens to Foggy, and then they established throughout the length of the season what Foggy meant to multiple people in the show.
Yeah.
And I think that part worked as well, because if by the end of the season you don't understand this was a big loss to them, I don't know what program you're watching. Yeah. And that was something that impact, I think, works on various levels, no matter what your experience is with this. So that's really strong writing, too. It's something comics do very well. And I think this show did it very well, where we feel the progression having watched those three seasons. But a new viewer can watch this one and just be completely caught up with who these people are.
Well said. And to add to that, when he's and the bullseye Daredevil fight is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. After Foggy is shot, unbelievable, the choreography in that. But you know, they kind of take the scene from the comic where Matt drops him after he kills Elektra. Just now it's Foggy, but the fact that he hears Foggy's heartbeat beat its last and then he drops him, you know, there's just, again, the torment of being Daredevil and the decisions that he makes. I was thoroughly pleased with this season on every level. You know what? One of my favorite parts, though, just to showing just the sheer fun of Daredevil's abilities, the bank robbery. Mm-hmm. Just him, not in the costume, but just showing off all his different skills in foiling. I just thought it was just really fun that whole episode.
Yeah, I agree. I thought, you know. I did hear some people say, oh, you didn't need this. This episode was a filler. I didn't think there was a wasted episode in there. I thought the whole thing was great.
No.
And my biggest disappointment with the series is that I got to wait for the next season.
But before I forget, I want to mention, how great was the Kingpin in therapy with his wife, by the way? Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then when we finally meet the character that, what was his, David, I think was his name.
Oh.
And then, you know, he gives him the fighting chance to get out.
Yep.
You know, that seemed so true to the Kingpin that it was perfect.
And not only that, I love this is a theme throughout the season, you know, how much he enjoys the elegance of a fine dinner. And a lot of key events happen when he's having a meal, either alone or with his wife. The juxtaposition of how brutal this man is, but also this is part of that just really craves this refinement that he wants to project. By the way, how good is Gandolfini's son as the Weasley up-and-coming opportunist who is one of his aides? I'm really enjoying that performance.
I agree. I am as well. I thought that he's just very, very Weasley. I just, you know, but he also, he's unlike the Kingpin, is a bully.
Yeah.
Well, the Kingpin is more calculating. The Kingpin will use people to his own ends. But I think this character just seems to enjoy using the power for his own ends as opposed to...
he's getting off on the power and having access to the power. And I love how they play him off against the more seasoned woman who's like the career political advisor. And he's kind of boxing her out by the end of the season. But in those scenes, like... even when D'Onofrio is just, you know, being the mayor and he's talking to different aides, he's still so intimidating. I mean, just he could be having a normal conversation. But you just know we're just under the surface. There is this monster that will just rip your lungs out in the right circumstances. It's great acting.
He's Weasley, but tonally accurate for the world. And I think that's something sometimes that gets lost. You make the character like too comedic or too disconnected where you don't feel like he's a force. You understand how this guy is a chaotic agent in this world. And he adds to the danger a lot of times. Of
what's You're talking on. About Kingpin or about his aide? I'm sorry.
His aide.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think his aide is something that was, I think, just very well written, because sometimes when you put in characters like that, they turn too comedic and will sometimes derail like the feeling and the tone of the series. They didn't do that with him, and I was glad that they didn't make that mistake, because I think the character works so much better because you understand what he's willing to do to survive. And those pieces, I think, make him fit into this world in a way that's really important.
And when the writing is really good there, Sean, to piggyback on that, is the relationship he has with Ben Urich's niece, yeah, who is really trying to bring the Kingpin down. And I'm sorry, I forgot the name of the character who plays the aide. I don't remember the name of the character, but the way he's manipulating their friendship for his own ends is really well done too. Sean's looking at that up right now as we speak.
Daniel Blake.
What is it?
Daniel Blake.
Daniel Blake. Thank you.
Yeah.
I thought the key moment for his character was when he screwed up. And he thought,
yeah, that's a great scene.
That's it. I'm done. And he understood how to get back into the Kingpin's good graces and did what he needed to, but still wasn't even 100% sure he was going to be successful. Like, no, you know, it was very well
played. He was spared.
He was spared and given more authority at that point because of his willingness to, you know, it's funny, you know, there was recently a post on Facebook I saw, and it said something to the effect of, you know, what's an expression that was common when you grew up that has fallen out of favor now? And I, being the wise guy I am, I put, it was my fault.
Look at Paul getting get off my lawn here. Wow.
It's a breath of fresh air to see someone who says, you know what, this was my fault. And I think that's what made the Kingpin accept him back. You know, I blame society for all of this because I think they, you know, people have been taught, well, you know, if there's something wrong in your life, it's someone else's fault.
But he also understood his audience, which I think is a real key off of that. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's fine.
He understood the Kingpin. He kept saying and preaching that he was a devotee, and I think that's genuine. I think he really sees the Kingpin as an opportunity for himself. And he knew exactly, like, I've got to throw myself on the sword right now, and I've got to tell him why I believe in him. It's the only way I'm surviving this. If he doesn't believe me, I'm done. I think he knew that. I think he knew he was completely done if he did not genuinely mean it. I think he did. And it worked to his advantage because he saw the Kingpin as being his way to climb up the ladder.
Oh yeah.
Boy, is he using that to his advantage.
I think this season was totally set up by the whole Kingpin winning the mayoral seat and doing so partially on a platform of no costumed vigilantes and letting it be known that if there are any vigilante actions, they're going to face his wrath. And he's getting the public sentiment behind him on that. And you see Matt trying not to act as Daredevil because of this, but circumstances occur that force him into it as far as, you know, his value system, that he has to go out and do things. And that's putting him directly against the Kingpin now. And it's setting up the conflict even more for season two of his character, not only fighting the Kingpin, but his character fighting the Kingpin with the perception that he's the bad guy.
Yeah. And because Fisk is a highly skilled demagogue and he's exploiting anxieties and insecurities that are out. I mean, this version of New York City is apparently the crime rate is very high. And they're always talking about all these different vigilantes and so forth. I mean, the Kingpin has his own private militia and the police force. And, you know, he's really trying to exploit concerns people have, and he's doing it in the story very effectively. It's again, it's a chilling performance.
Absolutely. And there's again, I can't go ahead, Sean. No,
there's something you guys said earlier that I want to just touch back on very, very quickly. The criticism of quote unquote filler episodes. I think this show is taken what's the best of 22 and 23 episode seasons of programs and put it in place. You need those episodes. Sometimes their story development, their character
moments,
they put beats in there. And this season is an example of one. Sometimes streamers make the mistake of cutting out episodes like that, not putting in that type of content, and you don't get the emotional attachment. We actually talked about the Affleck movie, how you crammed things in and didn't give a chance to develop.
That's why I like the bank heist episode so much.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bingo. That's exactly an episode where this season would have been poorer without it there. That added a depth and a layer to it that I really needed this season. I don't know what you could have cut from this season.
Well,
I really don't.
And speaking of depth and layer, when Murdoch and Fisk sit down in the diner, that scene couldn't have worked without the Netflix series, first of all. Like, you needed the weight of their relationship. But there's a great moment where the Kingpin says, I'm paraphrasing, says something like, I'm not completely unhappy to see you, or something like that. And like, there's, I don't know if respect is the right word, but there's an acknowledgement of each other's skills and abilities. And they even comment on how they like this certain restaurant. And the tension there is so profound between the two men, as the great acting, as they're kind of laying out their terms. And when Matt says, you know, if you cross over, I'm coming for you. And then he leaves, and Fisk just slaps the table with his hand. That's the only kind of physical reaction he shows. But when he does that, you feel the seething violence that's just below the surface.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think, you know, this series and the Netflix series, to me, in equal parts, both are buoyed by the acting performances, the script, and the direction. I think it's all just really put together. It all falls into place so well. And I agree exactly what you're saying. There are some, excuse me, slower episodes that are in there, but if you watch them with an open mind, instead of just looking for action scenes, you see we're getting character development. We're getting things that the story is being built on. You know, again, that scene in the diner is very, very strong, but there's no action in it. It's a battle of wills is what it comes down to, and it's great. And when it comes to willpower, I don't know that Matt Murdock has more than Wilson Fisk.
That's a good point.
Which makes it, you know, he doesn't have the physical presence of Wilson Fisk, and he doesn't have the backing of Wilson Fisk, and he probably doesn't have the willpower of Wilson Fisk. So that is setting up the battle of, you know, David versus Goliath. You know, and that's what makes it easy to root for him and hard to see how he's gonna beat him. And that's what makes for, you know, when it's done right and when they bring it to a successful conclusion, that's drama at its best, as far as I'm concerned. My favorite dramatic series of all time was Breaking Bad. I just think it was incredibly good. And one of the things about that series was they constantly put Walter White against the situation that you thought, well, this is it. There's no way he can get out of this. And then you'd watch, and he would get out of it in a way where you said, not only was it satisfying, but it was believable. And it was just, you know, that was what was so great about it. And that's what I'm feeling here. I'm feeling that level of drama. And again, A+. I can't recommend this series higher than it.
Jaws 1.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to note on this one, and it kind of goes without saying, but Disney/Marvel could have said, we're going to leave the Netflix stuff completely over at Netflix and recast everybody and kind of.
Well, they didn't.
Thing. And I know they have a history with that as far as the fact that they kept the characters that predated Disney and, you know, kept moving all that forward, which was a smart move. I'm glad with this choice that they made the decision to keep that lore and let some of that move forward and breathe. This casting is just brilliant. And the fact that the writing really took a look at work, clearly took a look at what worked at Netflix and brought it over here, has done nothing. But I'm with you. I want season 2, season 3, season 4, whatever they are able to do showrunner-wise with this and keep it going. There's a lot of meat on the bones for this one that we can still enjoy. So I hope we get that. Jaws, 100% Jaws 1.
Yeah, it's just, you know, again, if you haven't seen the Netflix series and the Disney Born Again series, do yourself a favor and watch it.
Amen.
I'm not going to say the same thing about the first two things that we talked about, the Trial of the Incredible Hulk and the Ben Affleck Daredevil movie. If you're a completist and you want to see them, yeah, that's fine. I saw them. It's not, you know, I don't feel like I'm, you know, I didn't want to tear my eyes out because of them, but they just don't compare to what came after them. So, Chris, thank you for making the time to come on.
Oh,
so always a pleasure, my friend.
A privilege and a pleasure, my friend. Thank you.
And Sean, always my fun. Always fun. And everybody who's listening, thank you so much, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
David Banner wanted to end the running. He wanted to live in peace.
You have to stop someplace.
But once again, they made him angry. Maybe angry enough to kill.
Maybe I belong in a cage.
Now, imprisoned, he will struggle to hide the fury within him. But he will not succeed.
I can't stand trial. You have no choice.
Because now David Banner faces his greatest trial. The trial of the Incredible Hulk.
Are you here to confirm that Daredevil is responsible for this, Detective?
There is no proof that Daredevil even exists.
He can hear it before it makes a sound. He can sense it before it happens. He can vanish before you realize he's there. And he's the last person you'd ever expect.
Police suspect the vigilante Daredevil was the one to bring the criminals to justice.
I don't know why you read that trash.
You want the truth?
Tell me.
She's hideous.
Excuse me. I just wanted to get your name. Does every guy have to go through all this to find out your name?
You should try asking for my number.
I've been following that piece you wrote about the Kingpin.
How do you kill a man without fear?
Let the bodies hit them.
Give me Bullseye.
The devil's mine.
I hope justice is found here before justice finds you.
How can you be a skeptic?
If there's no eyewitness, I mean, you know, Bigfoot has eyewitnesses.
Please.
When I was a kid, I used to dream what it would be like to live somewhere far away from Hell's Kitchen. But I realized the city was a part of me. It was in my blood. And I would do anything to make it a better place.
Good and evil. Sometimes the difference between the two is a sharp line. Sometimes it's a blur. Sometimes we have to do things outside of the law.
We're gonna make a difference. I know it doesn't feel like it sometimes, but we are.
You're blind, but you see so much.
I hear things.
You know what they call stuff like that? Gifts. I'm gonna train you. Use it.
There are other ways to see.
Each step I left behind.
I don't see the city anymore.
Each breath you take is mine.
There's only dark corners.
I'll keep you safe, Karen. I have to be the man this city needs.
What are you gonna do?
Whatever it takes.
We fight every night for something. When the sun sets, we're both the same.
You and I have a lot in common. We're nothing alike.
We can't go back for nothing. Take what you need, say goodbye.
Another man's evil does not make you good. I respect your conviction. The lone man thinks he can make a difference.
This darkness is the light.
I'm just trying to make my city a better place.
Maybe if he had an iron suit or a magic hammer, that would explain why you keep getting your asses handed to you.